lowest appellate for term of the United Inspector General of Division of Individuals past the tip. Mr. Cox, for the lead history, Mr. Hagan, for the afterwards.
Morning, Mr. Cox.
Good morning, Chief Judge Chantel. May it please the court. James Cox from Jenner and Block as court-appointed amicus curiae in support of appellant David Bowie. Your Honor, a series of legal errors by the district court deprived Mr. Bowie of a full and fair opportunity to prove his case. First, the district court erred in dismissing two of Mr. Bowie's claims prior to trial, a conspiracy claim under 42 U.S.C. Section 1985-2 and a First Amendment retaliation claim.
I want to come back to the conspiracy, but what was before the court that would have supported the retaliation claim at the time the summary judgment was granted?
To support the First Amendment retaliation claim?
Yes.
Your Honor, the evidence before...
He used his First Amendment rights, and a year and a half later he was fired. Is that... am I giving an accurate statement?
Your Honor, I think there's more to the timeline than that.
Okay.
Specifically, I think...
Is that timeline accurate? Then you can flesh it out.
That is correct, Your Honor. Mr. Bowie... in May of 2000, refused to sign a pre-prepared affidavit justifying the District of Columbia's rationale for terminating his subordinate, Emmanuel Johnson. And he ultimately was fired, actually, about 2 years after that, in July 2002.
2 years, okay, I'm sorry.
But, Your Honor...
It's even more attenuated than I thought. Then.
Your Honor, what connects those two events is a series of acts by the defendants leading up to Mr. Bowie's ultimate termination. And those sort of acts of progressively more severe retaliation and acts by Mr. Bowie in continuing to support Mr. Johnson's claims lead to that connection. In November of 2000, Johnson, after Mr. Bowie's speech, filed a complaint against the District of Columbia. Shortly after that, in February of 2001, Mr. Bowie was removed from a high-profile investigation into fundraising practices by the mayor's office. In November of 2001, motion to dismiss was denied.
Now, we just dropped 9 months.
Your Honor.
We went from February to November.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, Mr. Bowie has also alleged that during this entire time, there was a series of acts demonstrating the district's increasing hostility towards him as a result of his speech and his support for Mr. Johnson's case. Mr. Bowie alleged that from the time he first engaged in that speech, defendants Maddox and Anderson, the heads of the District of Columbia's Office of the Inspector General, criticized him for not stepping up to the plate in supporting the district's rationale for terminating Mr. Johnson. From that point on, the district continued its campaign of criticizing Mr. Bowie for his actions here. And with the pieces of retaliation sprinkled in, that series of events, that timeline, connects the two events you discussed. Now, returning to the errors that the district court made initially, the additional error the district court made was during the trial that actually occurred.
Let's go back to the conspiracy just one moment. Assuming, and it's not a bad assumption, that I agree with you that the intracorporate immunity doesn't apply to this kind of conspiracy. In fact, I'm not sure it should apply outside the antitrust context. Can you give me briefly, and we'll give you extra time if we have to, can you give me briefly what the evidence is that supports conspiracy? Forget about the intracorporate defense and just tell me what the evidence was that supported conspiracy at the time of the ruling.
Sure,
Your Honor.
Again, I think what's critical here is the timeline of events connecting Mr. Bowie's termination and the events leading up to Mr. Bowie's termination to the activities in Mr. Johnson's case. So Section 1985-2 creates a cause of action for a conspiracy to deter, by intimidation or threat, truthful testimony in federal court. The key events towards the end of that timeline were in April 2002, Mr. Bowie was identified as a witness to support Johnson's Title VII claims in a publicly filed document in the district court in Johnson's case. Almost immediately following that April 2000 identification of Mr. Bowie as a witness in early May 2002, there was correspondence between two of the defendants, Wright and Maddox, indicating essentially that Mr. Bowie's termination was fait accompli. Now, several of the defendants in this case.
What did it say? Instead of telling me what it indicated, what?
Sure. The correspondence is at page 325 of the joint appendix. Mm-hmm. And in that correspondence, Maddox basically writes a letter. Wright writes a letter to his supervisor, Maddox. And in that letter, he indicates that they had just had a conversation. That conversation clearly was about Mr. Bowie and his position as head of the Division of Investigations. And in that letter, Wright talks about the planning for the transition of that division after Mr. Bowie is removed, and the planning for a reinspection of that division.
The confidential document of May 19, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
What is your best language in that that supports a conspiracy to intimidate or?
Your Honor, I don't think the language in that reflects the conspiracy to intimidate.
That's
think the language.
That's the problem I have with it, too.
I think the language there reflects the action that the defendants are intending to take and the fact that the defendants immediately after Mr. Bowie was disclosed as a witness had intended to take this action against him. Your Honor, I think while
at
defendants...
Most, it seems to, at most, and that's a little bit opaque on that, it seems to support the proposition that they're going to terminate him, but termination doesn't give you a cause of action. Certainly not a 1985 cause of action.
Your Honor, I agree that the termination by itself would not create a 1985 cause of action. What I think does create a 1985 cause of action here is the series of events leading up to that termination, in which every time a key event occurred in Johnson's case, suggesting to defendants Maddox and Anderson that they may actually be at risk of liability
in
that
case. You have better evidence than that document for the proposition that there's a conspiracy.
Your Honor, I think...
You need a conspiracy for this claim for relief, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think the
evidence... That's your best evidence of conspiracy.
I don't think that there is one ironclad piece of evidence of a conspiracy. I think the best evidence of a conspiracy is that consistently throughout the period beginning in February 2000 and continuing through Mr. Bowie's termination in July 2002, every time an action occurred favorable to Johnson and Johnson's case, or Mr. Bowie took an action favorable to Johnson and Johnson's case, the defendants, either in concert or individually, took an action to retaliate against Mr. Bowie for his support of Johnson's case.
There seem to have been just a huge number of issues between Mr. Bowie and the individual defendants throughout this period. I mean, it's a stream of conflict. To zero in on the Johnson case has an arbitrary quality about it.
Your Honor, I think there is a stream of conflict, but I think that stream of conflict, I don't think it is arbitrary to connect that stream of conflict to Johnson's case. And I think a good way to look at that is through the progressive change in Mr. Bowie's performance evaluations. Mr. Bowie, prior to all of this matter coming forward, was receiving excellent performance evaluations from the district. In November 2000, he received a 4.9 out of 5 on a performance evaluation signed by two of the defendants. That's available at pages 317 and 318 of the joint appendix. As soon as this issue began to come to light, that changed. And I think you can see the exact conflict you just described, Judge Williams, emerging as a function of the changing relationship between the parties here. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time, please.
Any questions? Hearing none, then we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we'll hear from the appellee.
May it please the court, David Hyden representing Mr. Maddox and the other appellees in this case. The court should affirm the decisions and verdict of the district court below. I will turn immediately to the discussion that preceded us regarding the conspiracy claim, the 1985 conspiracy claim raised by Mr. Bowie below. There was no error by the district court in dismissing this claim at the pretrial conference. Contrary to the assertions of Mr. Bowie, there was a history of problems with his performance within the OIG dating from 1999. We know from the initial evaluation by the Inspections and Evaluations Division in December 1999, January 2000, that there were widespread problems within the Investigations Division, not just problems with the production of reports of investigations, but also in terms of lack of clear guidelines, regulations, revision of the guidelines for the division, and so on.
Did the district court dismiss this claim because of lack of evidence, or did they dismiss it on a different basis?
No, Your Honor, you're correct. It appears from the arguments at the pretrial conference that the dismissal was based on the intracorporate conspiracy doctrine. We believe there was no error in the court's application of that doctrine here.
Go ahead.
Why do you think that doctrine should apply in a civil rights case?
No reason both of us to ask that same question. Go ahead, counsel.
Once at a time, yes. Well, Your Honor, seven circuits have found that that the ICCD does apply in 1985 cases.
Well, they have, but they haven't done a very good job of analyzing why, and they've come up with a bunch of exceptions to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true, Your Honor, in that there are a couple of exceptions, the criminal and for the personal motives. But I would point the court to Travis, Judge Easterbrook's decision in Travis, which we think lays out quite clearly that both the history of the Ku Klux Klan Act and the application of the intercorporate doctrine or the conspiracy doctrine prior to that act's legislation's enactment. Judge Easterbrook noted that the doctrine and its basics that a corporation and its officers are one entity and therefore cannot conspire with itself well predated the Ku Klux Klan Act. We look at the commentary of Blackstone, the Dartmouth College case that Judge Easterbrook cited. The district has found a few other cases that predate this act as well. I'd cite the case of Prescott v. Gosner. That's 34 Iowa 175. That's an 1872 case. And Polar Star Lodge number 1 v. Polar Star Lodge number 1, 16 Louisiana Annotated 53. That's an 1861 case. And both of these cases seem to stand fairly clearly for this concept of corporations as one entity, the corporation and its officers with one entity. And we've argued.
It is one thing to say that an agent of a corporation cannot be in conspiracy with the corporation. It's another to say that the agents couldn't be in conspiracy with each other without the listing of the corporation as a conspiracy.
Yes, that's right, Your Honor.
And I'm wondering if that doctrine really, even outside the realm of civil rights, should protect individual employees of corporation, from conspiracy liability for conspiring just because they happen to work in the same corporate frame.
Well, Your Honor, I would point out that Mr. Bowie, at that point, had alleged that the district's officers and the district.
Yeah, assume then that we dismiss the district or grant summary judgment against the district. Does it make sense to continue to protect the district's municipal corporation, to protect the individual defendants under that intra-corporate
Conspiracy doctrine, yes.
Conspiracy doctrine.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I'd point the court to the case we cited in our brief, Bushi v. Kervin, the Fourth Circuit case. In that case, the Fourth Circuit found that by and large, the doctrine does apply to 1985 cases. It does make an exception for cases and
individual motive or whatever.
Personal
yes.
stake.
Well, yeah. Yes, but not only that, but that the personal motives dominated the decision. Mm-hmm. And in this case, Mr. Boies could make no showing that this is so.
Yeah. If that is necessary to avoid the application of the doctrine, then there doesn't seem to be much showing here of that, the personal motive.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, I would suggest to the court that that if the court feels that this question needs further investigation, that remand limited to this issue might be appropriate. There is certainly
it's a pure legal question at this point. I mean, the court had before it what it had before it, so I'm not sure what remand.
Understood, Your Honor. I would point out that the district courts here in the District of Columbia have relied on this doctrine extensively, and that disruption of the precedent might be something the court would want to consider.
But we don't have a precedent on this precise question.
No, not per se. Yes, Your Honor. Turning to the First Amendment retaliation claim, and again, as we were discussing, earlier, the allegations by the amicus of progressively more severe retaliation simply don't bear water. There was extensive testimony at the trial regarding the motivations behind the decision to terminate Mr. Boies. Mr. Maddox, Mr. Wright, all of the principals from the OIG testified at the district court regarding Mr. Boies' decreasing evaluations, increasing problems within the investigation division, which led eventually to his termination in August of 2002. I would point out one thing mentioned by amicus. Mr. Boies was named as a witness in Mr. Johnson's district court case in April of 2002. There's no evidence that any of the principals knew of this at the time. I'd also point out that there's a case that there's no temporal proximity between the April 2002 notice of this and the August 2002 termination of Mr. Boies. Yes, Your Honor.
I do have one question. That is the district court's exclusion of Miller's testimony.
Yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me that an argument can be made, in fact, Mr. Boies' counsel made it, that this was relevant evidence and would at least show a baseline that, you know, he was fired for presumably the slowness of this ROI process, mm-hmm. and yet that did not change after he was fired.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand your question. First of all, I'd say Mr. Boies' termination was not based simply on this ROI question. There were a number of problems with the investigation division at the time that he was terminated, leading up to his termination. Again, a failure to have clear operating procedures within the division, very slow production, confusion among the rank and file members about leadership. That led to his termination. I'd also argue that Mr. Miller's testimony would have been irrelevant to the question of Mr. Boies' performance. In my experience...
Not on the broad notion of relevance, right? I mean, it might be a brick or half a brick to make the wall, but it would be relevant, right? And particularly if it were accompanied by a complete showing of circumstances prevailing under the new leadership.
Leadership. Well,
that would get you into a question of whether it was on balance worth receiving.
Yes, Your Honor. And the evidence, in my experience with employment cases, subsequent performance by other employees is usually not permitted.
Yeah, this is not the same as prior history leading up to the time when the incident occurred.
Yes, that's exactly right, Your Honor. I would also say that the allegations by amicus of prejudice resulting to the jury are purely speculative at this point, and that any error by the district court in not allowing this testimony was harmless.
Any further questions? If not, then thank you, counsel. We'll
thank you very much, Your Honor.
2 minutes of rebuttal from...
I have a couple of questions. One is there any place in the defense counsel's summation in which he in any way relies on the ROI data? Because I couldn't see it. It may be inferentially there, but it's really not explicit. It didn't seem to me explicit.
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any place in the summation where we relies on the ROI data. I think the main importance of the ROI data, my opposing counsel alluded to the testimony that occurred at trial and talked about the witnesses for the defendants, primarily the defendants themselves, testifying about Mr. Bowie's performance and giving their subjective accounts of how Mr. Bowie performed. Also at trial, there was a series of witnesses saying exactly the opposite and giving a diametrically opposed account of how Mr. Bowie performed. And I think the importance of the ROI data in all of this is that it was sort of the one objective piece of evidence that the jury could use to compare these two.
But apparently not worth being invoked by defense counsel, which if it were highly material, you would expect.
Your Honor, I can't speak to why defense counsel didn't invoke it, but I think plaintiff's counsel very likely would have had they been able to introduce
the
evidence showing that the ROI production was not borne out by the facts.
I have several problems with finding error in not allowing the use of subsequent performance, because certainly that information was not available to the decision makers at the time they decided to let him go. That's problem one, which makes it, I think, of very limited relevance. I mean, if you had somebody before him that had performed poorly and been promoted, or performed equally to him and been promoted, the relevance would be evident. But the subsequent performer, what you're doing there is introducing something of very marginal relevance and opening the door to all sorts of evidence about why the evidence afterward is not comparable. Changes in policy, changes in burden. So, can we really say the judge abused discretion by not allowing something that is of, I think, marginal relevance and could have opened the door to all sorts of confusion? Is that really abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, I think it is. First, sort of the relevant standard in Rules 401 and 402 is a very low bar, and I think the significance of...
But the review standard we employ is abuse of discretion, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor, but that standard of abuse of discretion is reflected against the low standard of relevance under which the district court here concluded that this evidence wasn't relevant. And I think the key framing of the question as to why it's relevant is that the question here isn't how Mr. Bowie performed, it's what the motivation for defendants was in terminating Mr. Bowie.
Right.
I think in...
Right, that really hurts you, didn't it? Because they don't have to show that they were correct in their analysis. I mean, they could be wrong about him performing poorly as long as they fired him because they thought he was performing poorly.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think what happened after Mr. Bowie was terminated reflects on whether or not that was their true motivation. The defendant's conduct towards a person who replaced Mr. Bowie, who continued to perform and performed more poorly than Mr. Bowie, at least as measured by this one metric, ROI production, didn't suffer the same fate that Mr. Bowie did. Three quick points, if you may, Your Honor. You can cut me off whenever
we have talked you past your time, but go ahead.
Turning back to the conspiracy claim, the Section 1985-2 claim was dismissed on a motion to dismiss under the 12b6 standard. So that's the standard that this court should be reviewing it under, not a summary judgment standard. Second, regarding the history of the intracorporate conspiracy doctrine, the authorities that defendants cited primarily don't deal with conspiracy whatsoever. They deal with treating a conspiracy as one entity in other contexts, as the law assuredly did. But the precedent for the application of this doctrine in conspiracy cases didn't exist when the 1871 Ku Klux Klan Act was passed. Third, regarding the evidentiary issues, I think both evidentiary issues, the issue regarding ROIs and the issue regarding the sort of patently improper judicial notice of the result in Johnson's case, are substantial.
Why is that patently improper? I mean, let me give you the case. Suppose it were stipulated that the Johnson claim was completely meritless. Would that be irrelevant? Noting the low bar for relevance.
Your Honor, no. I think in that case it would not be irrelevant, okay, because so I think there it would legitimately bear on Mr. Bowie's credibility. However, here there was no finding.
Well, good men and women, true, find it to be at least not a winner. Is that irrelevant?
Yes,
probably not 12 anymore in the civil case.
Oh, well, all right.
Unfortunately, I would say, in my view.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that it is irrelevant to the legal standard, to the legal elements of a retaliation claim. The only reason why it could conceivably...
Retaliation has to be for a... It doesn't have to be a winning argument or contention on the part of the person retaliated against. But if the position taken against which there's retaliation is completely unwarranted, I forget the exact, I think baseless is, in fact, the term, then you don't have a good retaliation claim. Now, I recognize that the jury verdict is not a finding of utter baselessness, but it is, I would think, a brick towards that wall.
Your Honor, I don't think that a jury verdict is a brick towards a wall of a finding of utter baselessness. Indeed, the mere fact that Johnson's case went to trial, I think, is a statement suggesting that it's not utterly baseless. However, I think introducing the result is an invitation to the jury to treat it exactly as you're suggesting, as utterly baseless, and as a
demerit. No, I was only, inviting them to treat it as a brick.
as a brick towards that wall, and I think even as that brick, I think it has a significant bearing on how the jury in this case would affect Mr. Bowie's credibility.
Was there not already a lot of language about that litigation before the jury at the time the judge made the judicial notice?
Your Honor,
the jury had heard a whole lot about the Johnson claim. Right?
There was information about the Johnson claim.
Yes, so I'm not sure why it is more unfair prejudice to have the jury know how that litigation terminated than it is to leave them with all kind of evidence about the case and wondering how the litigation terminated.
Your Honor, I think in wondering how the litigation terminated, the jury would not be invited to use the result of that litigation to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses in a way that sort of invites improper speculation by the jury. And I think inviting that speculation would be extremely
harmful. Deciding which eventuality causes the most improper speculation is perhaps better for the district judge than for us, isn't it?
Your Honor, I think it's extremely relevant here that the district court didn't even make the inquiry that it was supposed to make. It never considered whether the information about the verdict in Johnson's case was relevant in Mr. Bowie's case. It simply held that because it meets the judicial notice standard under Rule 201, they don't even have to consider relevance, and that's sort of clear error under this court's precedent.
Even if you think that was problematic, didn't he have an opportunity to offer a curative instruction?
Your Honor, I think it is a reasonable tactical decision to decide that having that curative instruction would have simply reminded the jury once again of the verdict in Johnson's case and the challenge to Mr. Bowie's credibility that came about with it, and not seeking to have the jury reinstructed and reminded about that again, I think was a reasonable choice for Mr. Bowie's counsel to make.
Can we turn to the broad question of 1985? You have then Judge Breyer's, in many respects, quite compelling analysis to why it should not be extended, that Copperwell should not be extended from antitrust. But you have seven circuits that have nonetheless made precisely that extension. Are you suggesting that their view of the matter is completely unpersuasive?
Not completely unpersuasive, Your Honor, but ultimately incorrect, at least as applied to this case. Yes, Your Honor.
Well said.
Isn't a possibility of what may have been going on, and I recognize it doesn't appear in any of the opinions, that this appears in an area where there have been elaborate statutes which represent complex compromises between interests, and to apply the full language of 1985 in that context is to upset all those trade-offs.
Your Honor, 2 points. First, I think sort of a post hoc compromise involved in some other statute shouldn't influence the determination of what Section 1985 itself encompasses.
Well, that may be why the courts haven't mentioned it.
And the second point I would make very quickly is that I think Section 1985 itself includes language that limits the reach of the statute. It has to relate to testimony in a federal case. It has to be an action to deter. Yes, I'm sorry, within Section 1985, too. Yes, Your Honor.
But we, 1985, taken as a whole, is very broad.
Yes, Your Honor. I think Section 1985-3 is a broader statute, although it, too, has significant limits in it. But as applied specifically to 1985-2, I think there's less of a concern.
I don't think anyone is proposing that Copperweld apply to 3 but not to 2, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I'll thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank you for accepting the responsibility for service in the amicus role in this case. We thank you on behalf of the court and the United States for your excellent performance.
Your Honor.